start the calculus of variations topic, but first I want to make a couple of comments about yesterday's lecture. And sorry if, sorry for the confusion and also that it took so long. It was kind of a long lecture. But anyhow, so the first point is about the bi and bi bar variables. So you are absolutely right, they are Grassmann variables. This doesn't change anything about what we did, but just it's an important comment. And for the people who wanted to know what is the relation with physical quantities, say when you are going to consider in quantum field theory at some point integrals, the partition function for fermionic fields, say like the electron or proton. So in that case, those fields are going to be some sources for the fermionic fields. And instead of thetas, you're going to have some Dirac fields that describe those. And the matrix A is going to be related to the inverse propagator or the Green's function. So anyhow, that's just a small comment about that. Doesn't affect anything, but it's indeed important to remember that they are Grassmann variables too. And the other comment somebody was asking at the end about why the Jacobian of the transformation from theta to eta, from eta to eta tilde, the transformation that we did with the unitary matrix in order to diagonalize this matrix A, why the Jacobian was equal to 1. So, and some people were wondering about change of variables with Grassmann variables. So the most like simple way to see that the Jacobian is equal to 1 is just to do the most straightforward simple thing. Just take the product that you have in the measure for the eta variables and eta bar and just plug these substitutions directly into those products. And then you can just write everything out and you see that you get exactly so determinant of u from here, determinant of u inverse from here, and you're left with just the measure for the eta tilde variables. So I hope everybody can check this. And this is just identically the expression for the determinant. So anyhow, if there are any more questions about that, come later, but let's begin the new topic now. And again, sorry for the confusion from yesterday. So now we're starting a new topic, which is calculus of variations. And the plan for today is the following. So first, we're going to talk about functionals. Then about functional derivatives and the Euler Lagrange equations. Euler-Lagrange equations are also most of the time called just equations of motion for a physical system. We're going to see why. So they are going to give us the usual equations of motion. And finally, we'll see a simple example, which is Lagrangian mechanics. So we'll see a simple example of this variational description for, say, for classical mechanics. Okay, so let's begin with the first point. So, well, of course, everybody knows what is a function, but let me just say this so that I can say how a functional generalizes that. So you know that a function yx, x is the variable, can be viewed, well, can be viewed as a map that, given a real number, it gives you another real number. So it's a map that sends the real numbers into themselves. So both x and y are real numbers. Now, the notion of functional is similar. However, a functional is a map that sends a function into a real number. So if you're given a function, then the functional tells you what number that equals to. So a very, very trivial example of this is actually, if we just fix one point, say we take x to be equal to some concrete number, 2 or 5 or something, and then evaluating every function at that point, this is a number, right? So this is like the most trivial example of a functional. Much more interesting example of a functional is actually provided by the definite integral, and that's what's going to be of interest in physics. So now we turn to a more interesting example. Well, let me write here. So, more interesting example. Definite integral. So let's consider definite integral from some initial point xi until some final point xf of some function that can depend, well, some expression that can depend on the variable and on some other function that depends on the variable. So this is a number. So this integral is a functional that maps this f into a number. Well, really maps the function y. So more generally, the kinds of functionals that will be interesting in physics and in quantum field theory, and even before that in classical mechanics, more generally, the interesting functionals look like this. So let's introduce this kind of notation. J would just mean a functional. And the square brackets denote that it's not a function. So its argument is a function. So this is some function of x. So since the functional maps a function into a number, the argument of the functional is a function, right? So that's the function y. Again, from x initial to x final. And some expression that depends on x, on y, and on y prime. Where, as usual, y prime is the derivative. So clearly, that's also a functional. And in fact, one can consider also dependence on y double prime and so on to as high order as one wants. But in physics, it turns out that it's enough to go only up to the first derivative. Actually, all kinds of Lagrangians, say, in quantum field theory that are used in particle physics always have this form. So there's no need at this level to consider higher derivatives. But in principle, one can do that. There is no restriction on the mathematical side. It's just that it's not of physical interest. So, okay, so again, so this is a functional that maps the function y into a number. And later on in physics, we'll see that this number will be called the action. And the quantity inside the integral, the integrand, will be the Lagrangian. So, but we'll get there. Okay, any questions so far about things probably people are familiar with those notions? So let's consider now functional derivative, which is a generalization of the notion of a derivative of a function, but it's going to look much more non-trivially. So when we have a function, we can use the derivative to explore when the function has a minimum or a maximum, so in generally when it's extremized. Now, we can develop the same technique for a functional. So the question here is, what kinds of functions would provide extrema of this functional? And the functional derivative is going to be the tool to answer that. So to do that, let's first consider the following variation. So we are changing the function by some small amount. By small, I usually mean, like always in mathematics, infinitesimal. So what that means is that let's plot the function. So let's say that the function looks something like that. And this is the initial point, xi, and the final point, xf, is the x-axis. So that's the original function. Here we plot y. So the variation then is some small deviation. Let's say that it looks something like that. So it's almost the same, but quite close. Oh, well, there is a slight change, but it's not very different. So let's say that this is the original function y, and this is y plus delta y. So at each value of x, y plus delta y has slightly different value than just y. And also, there is the following important condition. And also, we take delta y to vanish at the endpoints. So we have this called fixed endpoint variations. So delta y of xi is 0, and delta y of xf is 0. Or another name for it is fixed boundary conditions. So variations with fixed boundary conditions. This is also most of the time what's done in quantum field theory. But I should just make a brief comment that sometimes, in more non-trivial cases, one can have some contributions from the boundaries. But for now, ignore that. Just that in principle, you should keep in mind that this is an assumption. This is not something essential for the variational principle. It's just an assumption that we are only going to study for now variations with this boundary condition. But there could be, like for example, in string theory, there are interesting cases in which fields have non-trivial asymptotics and things are happening on the boundaries or at infinity. So keep in mind, again, that this is an assumption that in more involved cases could be relaxed. But for now, we're just considering always variations with fixed boundaries. So now, we want to consider, when we do this kind of variation of the function y, how does the functional change? So the variation of the functional and we're going to define it just like for a function. So we consider the functional at y plus delta y. And we subtract the functional at just y. So we want to evaluate this quantity that tells us how the functional changes when we change the function. Again, note that here we're not talking about varying with respect to the variable x. That's not at all the case. We are just varying the function. That will be important in a moment. So that's the variation of a functional. So let's compute this. So what that means, let's substitute in both of those expressions just this defining property of our functional. So we have now integral from xi to xf. OK, let me write in more detail dx. F of x, y plus delta y, y prime plus delta y prime. So when we change the function y, the derivative also changes. So there is also delta y prime here. Minus f of x, y, y prime. And again, here, it's important to stress, like I said, we are only varying the function. We are not going to vary the variable x inside the integrand. So for example, this looks like a derivative with respect to y, but not a derivative with respect to x. And that's what I'm going to do right now. So since the variation y is infinitesimal, we're going to Taylor expand in delta y. But again, we're not going to be expanding in x, just in delta y in the integrand. So expand in small delta y, and we have integral from xi to xf dx. Now, this expansion means that we have df dy delta y plus df dy prime delta y prime. And the next order is quadratic in the variation, delta y or y prime squared. So we are going to only work to leading order. Since delta y is small, we're going to neglect the higher order. So again, the zeroth order just cancels, and we're left with the derivatives. And again, there is derivative only with respect to y, because we are varying y. We're not doing any derivative with respect to x here. So any questions so far about this? Yeah, OK. What do you mean acting on? Delta j is a functional that depends on y, right? So a functional maps a function into some number. Yes. So the function here is y. So the functional j maps the function y into a number via integrating it. Which equality sign? Which sign do you mean?
On left-hand side, actually saying delta j acting on 1.
Oh, sorry. Probably you want to specify. I think you want to specify here, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. You're right. And also here. Of course, so both of those are functions of y. So of course, the variation is also a function of y. So indeed, delta j maps y into a number. OK, so let's continue. Delta j of y is equal. OK, so now we can do partial integration. We can write, well, the term that is df dy prime. So this term we can partially integrate. And why we want to do that? Because we want to have only delta y in both terms, right? The first term has delta y, the second delta y prime. So we want to move the prime on the other side, so that we have delta y in both places. So we partially integrate this term. And that gives us integral from xi to xf dx. df dy minus, so this came from the first term, df dy, that was directly multiplied by delta y. Now this is what comes from the partial integration, d dx df dy prime. And now we have delta y multiplying both terms. Okay, well, and we also have a boundary term, which is df dy prime delta y evaluated at xi and xf. So write this and this, those terms came from partially integrating that one. So far everything clear? And finally, this term is going to vanish because we are considering only variations with fixed boundaries. So delta y is zero at both xi and xf, right? So because we're considering only fixed boundary conditions, this is just integral from xi to xf dx df dy minus d dx df dy prime delta y, and that's it. So now this quantity is usually denoted, well, this is the functional derivative. Of the functional J, and it's denoted usually in the following way, delta J delta Y. So this the notation for this same expression, df dy minus d dx df dy prime. So this is the notation for the functional derivative. So finally, maybe let me just write this. So the whole variation of J can be written in a way that is very suggestive, looks very much like a ordinary derivative, delta J delta Y dx. Okay, any questions so far? Okay, so now there is the following definition. If delta J, the variation of a functional, vanishes for, well, variations of some function, some particular function y, then this function, and again, by variations here, we always understand with fixed boundary conditions, then this function is called stationary point of the functional. So let's say I want to specify some particular function. Let's say there is some kind of function. So because this is the generic for any function, right, the functional. So if there is some kind of function for which it vanishes, then this stationary point of the functional j of y. So this is very much like the definition for an ordinary function. Right, if the derivative of the function vanishes, then the point at which that happens is a stationary point. The only difference is that now, instead of a point, we have a function. And there is also a theorem that is also very similar to ordinary calculus. The theorem stating that the functional j of y is stationary. So stationary means extremum, right? Means that it has either minimum or maximum or saddle point. So it's stationary under fixed boundary variations y going to y plus delta y if and only if the functional derivative delta j delta y vanishes for every x in the interval xi, xf. So again, this sounds very familiar, but instead of a function and its argument, here we have a functional and a function as its argument. Go here. Are there any questions? Yeah.
What is the general definition of the derivative function? That the functional form left of the middle form?
The general definition of the functional derivative is this, right? No, the function f here that gives the functional is arbitrary. We haven't specified what f is.
But if you assume it's a form
integral. Okay, so we're considering exactly that kind of integral. Let's see whether it was, maybe. So we are considering functionals of this form. And that's the general form of the functional derivative for this kind of functional. We are not studying any other functional. So in any specific case, you have to derive. And to derive it, you do the same kind of thing. Like in upper board right corner, you take the variation. If the boundary conditions are not fixed, what that means is that you're going to have the same functional derivative, but the fields are going to have different boundary conditions. So if that was some quantum mechanical system and you're studying some field configuration, so this, the vanishing of the functional derivative will give you the equations of motion. And the equations of motion in this standard derivation would assume that all fields vanish at infinity. That's what happens in quantum field theory in Minkowski spacetime. But if we have some contributions from the boundary, as can happen in non-trivial configurations, even in QFT with topological non-trivial configurations or in string theory, you could have fields that have non-trivial asymptotics at infinity or at some boundary. So you have the same equations of motion that are satisfied normally, but the boundary conditions are not trivial. Fields don't go to zero. That's the difference that Yeah, probably will become more clear after we study more QFT and other things. Can I generalize what? Tensors. Oh, you want a functional that maps a tensor into a number. Is that? I don't know. Is that what you mean by? Well, maybe it will be a new mathematical object, but it's not going to be called functional, right? Yeah. But I guess you're welcome to develop the theory of, I don't know, tensor functionals or something. But let me just complete the comment about the boundary conditions. So the configurations that I was talking about when fields have non-trivial asymptotics, these are usually non-perturbative configurations. So in any perturbative states, like you most of the time deal with in quantum field theory, fields are always going to zero at infinity. So these boundary conditions are usually assumed to be just for perturbative states and for perturbative calculations. In non-perturbative sectors, one can have non-trivial things happening at infinity or at the boundaries. Okay, so let me just again restate that theorem. So the condition to have an extremum, since that's important, so the condition for an extremum of a functional, again, functional of that same form. We're just always talking about this kind of functional here, nothing else. So the condition for an extremum of a functional is the vanishing of the functional derivative, which, so, well, is dy, dj dy equals zero, which is the same as df dy minus ddx, df dy prime equals zero for every x in x from xi to xf. So in quantum mechanics, usually you have some initial and final, say, moments of time or something. But in quantum field theory, these are going to be quantum fields. So usually the boundaries are just minus infinity to plus infinity. You have the whole space-time, or, well, we'll see that also a bit at the end of this lecture. So this is the important extremum condition. And the stressing of this point just means that this vanishing should not be due to choosing some particular point x. It should be true. It should be solved by finding a particular function, a particular form that, yeah. So this should be solved as an equation for the function, not for a particular point x. That's the meaning of requiring that it should be true for any x. And this equation is the Euler-Lagrange equation. The Euler-Lagrange equation is also the equation of motion of a physical system that is described by a Lagrangian, or more generally by an action. So let me write a slightly more general configuration. So for the moment, we consider it just a single function y. And for example, in physical situations, that could be some spatial coordinate as dependent on time. But in principle, a physical system can be described by many more spatial coordinates. There can be many degrees of freedom. So it's also of interest to consider functionals that, again, still depend on the function and the first derivative, but depend on more than one function. So more generally, the functionals that are of interest have this form. Again, we denote them by J, but they depend on, let's say, n different functions. For example, if you have some system of n particles and each y is giving you the position of that particle along some trajectory with time or something like that. So again, integral from the initial point to the final point along the x-axis. And then some expression that depends on x and on all of the y's and all of their first derivatives. And we're not going to go into detail here, but the derivation is exactly like for the case of just one function. So the Euler Lagrange equations look like this. Df dyi minus d dx df dy I, dy prime I equals 0. And this is for each value of I from 1 to n. So if we have n functions that the functional depends on, we have n equations. The Euler-Lagrange equations become n, one for each of the functions. And again, these are giving you the stationary points of this functional. And they're the equations of motion for the physical system described by this. So okay, let's go on this side. So let's now consider the example of Lagrangian mechanics. And maybe that will also make it more clear why this is a useful description. Actually, tomorrow will become most clear why the Lagrangian description is a very suitable way of describing physical systems. And mostly that has to do with conservation laws, but that we'll consider tomorrow. So this is the third point of the plan for today, which is really an example of what we've been doing so far for the case of mechanics. So Lagrangian description of mechanics. Lagrangian mechanics. So let me first remind you the physical principle that is the reason that we use this formalism for this case. Well, the reason that we use variational calculus in physics, really, that's Hamilton's principle. So I'll just state it. That's the principle that the evolution of a physical system, evolution meaning, say, if it's a mechanical system, just the motion of the system, but in more complicated cases may mean more involved things. So the evolution of a physical system is described by the stationary points which means order Lagrange equations, as we saw. So it's described by the stationary points of a functional that we call action. So a functional called action. That's the physical action describing the system. So let's look now at the functional that is going to describe mechanics, classical mechanics, really. So we'll see how the Newton's second law follows from this. So let's consider the functional, the action. Consider the action. Now I'm going to denote it S. Before, I use J because that's more suitable for mathematical considerations. But in physics, usually the action is always denoted by S. So now I'm kind of changing notation. Sorry for that. So this is the physical action. And in this context, we can think of this function as the trajectory or path of some particle or some system. Path in configuration space. So let's consider this functional of integral. Now we are going to view the function y as a function of time. So again, sorry for change of notation, but this is more often used in physics. So before, before I had x, now it's going to t, and before the functional was called J, now it's going to be called S. So again, sorry, that's the math part, and that's the physics part. It's just standard convention, so you should be used to both of those. So now we start from some initial moment of time and with some final moment of time. And the integrand is going to be m y dot. Again, that's a standard notation in physics, right? That's the derivative with respect to time. Square over 2 minus some function that in physics is called the potential dt. So again, y dot is just the derivative with respect to time. And in fact, in physics, this integrand is called this the Lagrangian. And this called potential. So the Euler Lagrange equations for this functional now can be written easily using the formalism that we already developed. So again, we denoted the whole integrand by L. So the Euler Lagrange equations are then dL dy minus dt dL dy dot equals 0. So these are the same equations we wrote before with this substitution that instead of, okay, so and final substitution, instead of F, now we have L. And instead of X, we denote the variable by T. So having this explicit form for the Lagrangian, we can actually see how the equations of motion look like. And what we get, well, here we see that this gives minus dv dy. In these kinds of differentiations, remember that here we view y and y dot as independent. So for example, this derivative is just the derivative of this term with respect to y dot. We do not differentiate this with respect to anything. And when we take this derivative, again, we only differentiate with respect to y itself. So only this term gives contribution. This term is not explicitly dependent only on y, so it just gives 0 in this derivative. So for these purposes, y and y dot are viewed as independent in these differentiations. Okay, and this gives y dot. So then when we take another derivative, it's going to become a second derivative. So we get m y double dot is equal to, and both terms are with minus, so this becomes equal to minus dv dy, which we can recognize as the force, right? So you know that the conservative force is minus the gradient of some potential. So this is Newton's second law. And y double dot is the acceleration. So that's Newton's second law. So any questions so far? Yeah, so now I'm going to, generalize. So indeed, more generally, we can have many so-called generalized coordinates. Which do not have to be Cartesian and do not even have to be positions, could be angles or various other things that characterize the system uniquely. So generalized coordinates. And they're usually denoted by Q. So again, sorry for changing the notation, but again, this is standard in physics. So we can have many generalized coordinates, qi. Let's say again, I goes from 1 to n. And so the action will be a function of all of them. Again, it's an integral from the initial time until the final time that we consider, dt, and then the Lagrangian that can depend on t and on all of those generalized coordinates and their first derivatives. And by the way, another reason to consider only first derivatives is that initially when this formalism was built for physics, people were just trying to reproduce Newton's second law. And if we had higher derivatives in the Lagrangian, you would not get a second order differential equation as the equation of motion. So in order to have only second derivative in the equation of motion, you have to have at most first derivative in the Lagrangian. So that was the first reason to start restricting to only first derivatives. And of course, later on, as I said, in quantum field theory, we know that all the Lagrangians that we need for particle physics also contain only up to first derivatives in fields. So, okay, so let me also stress the point that the generalized coordinates qi, the whole set of qi, don't have to be Cartesian. And they're just some set of coordinates that describe uniquely the system. By,
would you mind expanding on what you mean by uniquely here?
Well, for example, that's an example I'm going to give soon. But if you have, say, some particle moving on a circle, then the unique description will be some angle. If you say, well, OK, you know where it was in some initial moment of time, and then the angle tells you in which point it is at every other moment of time. So that's the angle is a first example of a generalized coordinate. No redundant, but also they're enough, right? For example, if the particle is moving in a two-dimensional space, it's not enough to say to specify an angle. You also have to say where it is in the other orthogonal direction. So in that case, just theta would not be enough. So by you describe uniquely, I mean that they are enough numbers so that you can describe everything, and there are no redundancies. And like before, the order Lagrange equations for this functional. This may be a bit annoying, but let me repeat it once more. That's the last time. So the Euler Lagrange equations are, again, well, the usual. I just want to write it in the new notation to avoid any confusions in the future. ddt, dl, dqi dot. For every I from 1 to n. So let me know if the example that I started mentioning there, example for a generalized coordinate. So let's consider a particle that is freely moving. That freely just means that there is no potential on a circle. So let's say that the two spatial directions are x and y, and then we can specify the position by giving an angle, and let's say the radius of the circle is r. So the Cartesian coordinates can be written in the usual way in terms of the angle. And so then the Lagrangian, like I said, freely means no potential. So the Lagrangian only has a kinetic term. So the Lagrangian is just, well, the particle has mass m, right? So that's a standard notation. So the Lagrangian is m over 2 times this, the velocity, which now is x dot squared plus y dot squared. And we can substitute directly this in the Lagrangian. And we see that this is equal to m over 2 r squared theta dot squared. So that's our Lagrangian now. And we see it depends only on theta dot. And here, this is then the generalized coordinate that describes uniquely the motion of this particle. So the larger point is that, in general, the generalized coordinates qi can be various things. So they can be angles. They can be radii or some other things, say some small deviations from some kind of equilibrium point. And in systems that are not purely mechanical, generalized coordinates can be also various other quantities that have nothing to do with position in space. We're almost done for today, don't worry. It's not going to be like yesterday. So let me give you one more slightly more involved example, which is actually kind of similar, but exemplifies a little bit the other point that also radii can be generalized coordinates. So example 2. So we can just consider the motion of a free particle, but now in polar coordinates. So in this case, we can again parameterize the Cartesian coordinates as upstairs, as r cosine some angle and r sine some angle. But now both the radius and the angle are variables because this is a free motion, say, in the xy plane. So here, both r and theta are generalized coordinates. And you can convince yourselves that now the Lagrangian gets slightly modified from the expression there. Namely, it's equal to m over 2 times r dot square plus r square theta dot square. And now it's a nice exercise for all those techniques to just see whether the Euler Lagrange equations. So I'm just going to state them. You can check at home that it's true. So since there are two coordinates, there are two Euler Lagrange equations, right? One of them is with respect to r, the other with respect to theta. So we have d dt of dl dr dot minus dl dr equals 0. And d dt dl d theta dot minus dl dt d theta. So in this simple example, it may not seem very useful to go to polar coordinates, but in more involved cases, generalized coordinates may be extremely useful. In some cases, actually, solving the system is almost equivalent to finding the right coordinates in which the equations are more simplified enough. So it's good to know this concept and be able to use it. So, okay, so you can practice at home to see that this Euler Lagrange equation becomes r double dot minus r theta dot squared equals 0. And this other one becomes theta double dot minus 2 over r dot theta dot equals 0. And you can even practice more if you want to see for yourselves that the solution is a straight line. So that's something that we know. If there are no forces acting on the particle, it just keeps going on a straight line. But like I said, it's a nice practice in this simple example to master the techniques that in more complicated examples may become crucial to solving the system at all. OK, so any questions? That's all that I wanted to say for today. OK, I guess then everything was clear. All right, that's it.